All right. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce our guest today, who is Dr. Julie Washington. She's a professor at the University of California, Irvine. Before that, she was a professor at Georgia State University for about 10 years.
Yes, 10 long? Years. Yep, 10 years.
And before that, we were colleagues at the University of Wisconsin, where we met. Julie's a great friend and research collaborator and someone who's just a joy to work with. I'm sure that the people who are tuning into this discussion know about Julie and her work. I would just say, Julie, you started out as your degree is in your doctorate is in speech pathology, and you started out as someone who was interested in the spoken language of African American kids and the properties of that of African American English, and also the issues that arise in trying to identify developmental language issues in children who speak African American English. Later, you also became interested in reading, and that's the place where we connected. Maybe I could just ask you how if you could say something about how your background as a speech pathologist really influences the way you think about issues about language acquisition, about language variation, and you know about reading, because I think that's really kind of an important thing about the way you view things. So you're a speech pathologist.
Yes. So, you know, in the beginning, Mark, I thought I was only interested in language, and I was always interested in African-American kids and cultural differences in the use of language and how they influenced assessment. And so as a speech pathologist, I was really interested in the fact that in those days, African-American kids were overrepresented on special education caseloads. And unlike now, where they're kind of underrepresented in speech and language impairment, they were overrepresented in those days. And so my question really was, how are we contributing to this problem of overrepresentation with this population? And so I went into the schools. At that time, I was at the University of Michigan. And so I went into the schools in Ann Arbor, and it was really clear from the outset that kids were really having trouble with reading, that the majority of kids at second and third grade weren't reading anywhere close to grade level. And so that kind of moved me, my thinking forward to, okay, we know there's an issue with assessment, but there also appears to be a real reading problem. And so how does language, and particularly language variation, contribute to these issues, or do they contribute? There was some work at that time, you know, I think it was first suggested in the late 60s that the relationship between language variation in the African-American community and reading existed, but there hadn't been any real systematic investigation.
There was research, but and it was okay by the standards of the era, but it wasn't very good. And in fact, people prematurely decided that language variation among speaking dialect, as speaking African-American English, wasn't a major factor in education. But that was a premature, that kind of cut off the research prematurely, because it really hadn't been established.
No, it hadn't. And, you know, one of the things that we saw in our lab at Michigan that was really clear was that when people were investigating dialect and its relationship to a lot of things educationally, that there wasn't a direct relationship. And because the relationships weren't so clear, people quit. So right. When look at the research in this area, there's like a 20-year gap in the research where people just sort of abandoned the whole idea.
I know. And But of course, what's different now? Now we have the idea that there are, sometimes they're called risk factors, but the idea is that there are a number of factors that combine, and no one of them is necessarily going to produce a single outcome. It depends how they combine with other things. So if, for example, you have, if you have a combination of these kinds of risk factors, like poor school or access to resources, plus low parent education level is low. It's the combination of the things that has the impact. It's not any of the factors necessarily on its own.
Exactly. So we have, what's changed is what you're describing, some of the knowledge base. The other thing that changed, Mark, was the tools. And so, for example, when I first started doing this work, we all remembered like BMDP, these like really crude ways of analyzing data. Yes. and then when you and I met at Wisconsin, and I was, we were talking about computational models. And, we had this conversation about whether this mismatch hypothesis about the mismatch between oral language and written language really was the part of the answer, because it was something that had been talked about since the late 60s, but nobody could really prove it. And so we assumed it, but we didn't really have the evidence. And so when you and I talked about computational modeling, it resulted in that 2015 paper where we really did see a relationship between this mismatch and how many trials it takes for a child to master or text. And so some of the difference is the tools that we have, that we can now study these questions in different ways. And where we're not talking about causation, we can see the relationships much more strongly than we could in the early days of this research.
You know what, in science, in other sciences, this is something I didn't learn until relatively late. A lot of the progress really is driven by advancement in the technologies and tools that are available. And that happened in this field. Now we just need more people to use them to study these particular issues. But before I don't want to skip over one thing that you were mentioning there, which was the over and under identification of African-American kids as for special education or as language impaired. Do you want to say a little bit about what the current, has anything changed there other than in terms of accuracy of identification, or is it just, what's changed and what are the risks in that area still?
Accuracy hasn't changed a lot. We're still not very accurate. But one of the, I think, big like structural changes that has happened is there's been a pendulum swing. We did this swing from over-identification to now people talking about significant under-identification. And that's particularly true in, the big areas that really influence academic outcomes, like identification of learning disabilities, identification of speech and language impairment. And so we've seen like this big swing from over to under identification, and both are quite harmful. And so what we really need is to be somewhere in the middle where we're accurate. And so the question is often asked, what led us to the under identification that we're experiencing now? Well, in the case of African-American children, there was a court case that I'm not sure people are always aware of in the late 70s, like around 1978, where a group of parents in the Ann Arbor Public Schools sued the school district because they said that their children who were African-American and used dialect were not being taught to read, and they were being put in special education when they didn't belong there. And this is called the Black English decision. And it happened in the late 70s, and the judge sided with the parents. And so what he said was, the parents are right, and we need to do a better job. Okay, great. But it was premature because we didn't have the evidence. It's an important case. It's a landmark case. But we didn't have the evidence or the skills to do what the judge told us we needed to do. So instead, what we saw in some school districts like Ann Arbor was a hands-off approach. So unless you were starkly impaired, you know, like you had Down syndrome. If you were African-American, you were not going to be called impaired, because then we started attributing everything to poverty and cultural differences. And then we saw the same thing with, RTI, multi-tiered systems of support, where all of a sudden now we now have this system where we can provide intervention in a special ed context at the highest level, but at tier one and tier two, we're doing, you know, in classroom support, we're doing strong classroom teaching. And what we have ended up doing, though, is using RTI or multi-tiered systems of support to circumvent special ed. So nobody ever gets to really tier three or tier four. Instead, they're kind of stuck at tier two. And so I think it's a combination of factors. It's like what you said earlier, it's not any single thing, but some of the knowledge that we have amassed over the last approximately 3 to 4 decades has been misused. And we have used it to keep kids from being overrepresented in special ed, but the reality is keeping them out of special ed is what we actually have done. And so now we're in the underrepresentation space, except in categories like behavior disorders and ADHD, so OHI, you know, otherwise health impaired. There are lots of African-American kids in those categories, but in those categories that have direct academic interventions tied to them, African-American kids, poor kids are significantly underrepresented.
Yeah. I mean, just the sheer, that's not tolerable. I mean, that being inaccurate is not okay. I mean, if you come from a poor background or you speak a variant of English that's different from the one in the books or other things, you can still have other kinds of impairments and they need to be identified. Part of the problem, I think, is that there just aren't enough researchers who can do the research to actually figure out what reasonable assessments would be to allow you to distinguish, make some very hard distinctions between, for example, whether the kid is speaking grammatical AAE or exhibiting features that in a speaker of general American English would be taken as evidence for an impairment. I mean, we could do a better job. It takes a certain number of people to do the research, and unfortunately the community isn't big enough yet.
That's right. There is a critical mass problem. There's also, I think, a problem with sort of our mindset in believing that if you're impoverished, that everything can be attributed to poverty.
Well,
so if you can't read, and you're poor, it's because you're poor. If you're having trouble with language and you're poor, it's because you're poor. That is not true. There is differentiation within the impoverished population. They're not all just poorly performing students. And we have a colleague who I shall not name, but who once said to me, of course they're having trouble with vocabulary. They're poor. It's that kind of mindset that keeps us from differentiating and just throwing these kids all into the same bucket.
I really want to press on this because, of course, I was going to ask you about it. This is where the discussion often ends. So Sean Reardon, who's a terrific quantitative sociologist at Stanford, who can put together data sets in very revealing ways, you know, has that very dramatic figure. I'll put it on our webpage, which shows, you know, at a district by district level, a relationship between reading achievement and income, I mean, SES, poverty, and how well off you are. And it's clear, there's a relationship. That's where the discussion ends. Like people say, some very well-known educators and influential people say, well, we can't do anything. You're too poor to help. And I think this is outrageous for the reasons that you're saying. First of all, it's not a monolithic condition. People differ, people's circumstances differ, and it's not a life sentence. I mean, it depends on other conditions. And moreover, poor kids are entitled to an education and indeed need more educational support and depend more on what happens in the schools than kids who have more resources in the home or the community. So nonetheless, the discussion often ends with poverty, man, can't do anything.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, when you think about poverty as an income issue, then I think scientists are on this thing where, you know, it's about money. So what, you give them money and their vocabulary improves? That's not true. There are a lot of sort of poverty risk areas, and there are skills that we see that are depressed because of the, why? Because you don't have money? No, because the absence of resources shrinks the experiences that kids can have. I live in California. Do you know that it costs $60 to go to the San Diego Zoo? So who's going to go? Who's going to get that experience? It's going to be the kids with the money. So if you're a parent who has three kids, it's almost $200 just for the kids, and you need to go in with them. And so we've created a context where your financial resources really dictate whether, what kinds of experiences and the quality of the experiences that you're going to be able to get. And when we think about that, you know, I'm talking about something like the zoo, but there are some simpler things. Like in our communities, we believe, for example, I love public libraries. It's the idea that books are free. You can go check out books. Well, I talked to a group of parents when I was living in Michigan, poor parents, and their school was next door to the library. And one of the things the teachers always said was, the library is right next door to where the parents live, and no child, and our kids don't go to the library. And so the teachers jumped to the conclusion that therefore the parents don't value reading and they don't value books. I don't believe that. And so I asked the parents, why don't you go to the library? And they said, it's because if the books get lost or the kids damage them in any way, we have to pay for it. Or if they're late, we have to pay. So for them, even something that we perceive to be free was about the financial penalty attached to getting those books.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, I was only thinking of the data which say there are fewer libraries, and in those libraries in poorer areas, and in those libraries, the books, there are fewer books and they're in worse condition and all these other things. But you're speaking to something that's a lot even more basic.
And the bigger thing for me is it's the resource issue, but it's also the assumptions that the teachers make about who the kids are and what the families value based on their behavior and based on the patterns that they saw. I think that's one of the big mistakes we make as educators, is taking our middle to upper middle class lens and using it to filter the lives of people who aren't living the same way we're living. And that's not fair. And it's often inaccurate. You come to wrong conclusions when you use your own filter to think about the values of people who are not in your community.
Absolutely. So I'd point to two related things. One is that a lot of curricular materials have that same problem. Namely, they're written for essentially a white middle class sort of culture, and not just culture, but assumptions about resources that are available and so on. It's not written from constructed from the taking into account the perspective of people whose lives are not like, who differ in a lot of ways. The other thing is, I think, a point you've often raised with me, which is, you know, parents also may not know certain things that they can do. That is, they want to help their kids, they want to do the right things for their kids, and in some cases, they just may not know. They may not know, for example, that, I don't know, various activities around reading to your kids or interacting with them in some particular way would be helpful. Right. And those are things that people actually can find out about. So there is sharing of information and helping people who want to do well by their kids.
Right. That's right. And, you know, there is so much that I'm of the mind that if you know what the rules are and you know what's valuable, why don't you share the information instead of just assuming that families aren't interested in it or they already know? And when we look at curricula for it in particular, not only are they not considering the cultural issues, I don't even think they're always paying attention to the data. So when you look at like the NAEP data, the majority of fourth graders, regardless of who they are reading at a basic level or below. So among African-American kids, that's 80%. Among white kids, though, it's still only 60% are reading at grade level, so 40% aren't. Right. So we keep seeing that, and yet we continue to have this third grade thing where, you know, learning to read, reading to learn. Well, our data show us that a significant number of kids are still learning to read in fourth grade. So why don't our curricula reflect that? And why don't our practices reflect it? So why aren't we continuing in our curricula as kids are moving into fourth and fifth grade to, in addition to focusing on the content in those grade levels, also focus on the reading skills that kids are still mastering at 9 years old?
Well, I mean, you can't skip over that, right? I mean, you can't just move on because the clock says you have to move on. I think about providing more opportunities for those kids to learn. You were talking about opportunities to experience the world and learn from experience before the kid gets to school, when the kid gets to school. Kids need enough opportunities to learn the things that will support basic reading, basic foundational skills. If you want to keep them on that kind of rough timetable, then you need to provide more opportunities for the kids to learn. There's more time on task. There may be more instruction. There may be more practice. If it can't be achieved by a certain deadline, you still have to carry it forward because it's what the later, more advanced kinds of literacy skills depend on. And if the kid doesn't get those or is still struggling with them or is still trying to master them, and they're being asked to learn these more advanced sorts of skills, it's going to compound their difficulties. And really, you know, you begin to get a cascade of failure. So I'd like to, you know, I think people would like to see kids stay on that kind of rough timetable, but either we're more successful with kids when they're younger, providing better instruction and more opportunities to learn, or we're going to have to continue that instruction for a longer time because the kids need to get it.
That's right. And even when we are doing a good job at those younger ages, continuing to do it is recognizes, I think, and acknowledges that kids are starting in very different places when they come to school. There are some kids who are absolutely ready to jump in and move on the way the curricula are presented, but there is a significantly larger number of kids who aren't, and who, as a result of starting in a different place and maybe a place that's a little further behind, need extra time at the other end, no matter how well you're teaching. And we have to allow that. Otherwise, we are perpetuating a culture of failure in reading and in academic achievement.
I think so. Also, you know, again, these are things we talked about in our article and in other places, but I think that we have to really be mindful about educational practices, instruction, curricula, and assessment that magnify differences in where kids are starting from. That right. is, the thing that was really eye-opening to me was that so many of the activities that are associated with early instruction just don't work the same way. They don't land the same way for many kids who are speaking AAE in a home and community. They don't work the same way. And so it has one impact on one child and it doesn't have the same impact on another child. And in doing so, being insensitive to that, we are magnifying rather than reducing the effects of different coming from different starting places. And this is totally unacceptable, you know? The assumption that there are going to be resources in the home and community, including things like things that cost money, is built into a lot of educational practices. And this is just a way to magnify existing differences. You take smaller differences and now you make them really big.
Exactly. And you know, Mark, in a lot of ways, some of the things that we're talking about for kids who are growing up in poverty and kids who use dialect are also true. You know, some of those same ideas are true for kids who have dyslexia, because the reality is they're starting at a different point with reading and they are having difficulty. But the difference is that many of the families are able to pull them out and get the acceleration and extra teaching that they need. But the variables, you know, the issues are basically the same. The variables that contribute may be different, but it's a different starting point, more difficulty with reading, need more time, need more opportunity, need a different kind of instruction. And for kids who are growing up in poverty, they have to stay in the public school to try to get it. And for kids who have dyslexia, they are often able to leave the public school and go somewhere where they're able to provide it. And therein lies the difference with the resources, that if you have the resources, you can leave and go get it. If you don't have the resources, you take what you get. And what we need to change is what you get.
So some of these conditions are, I'm wondering why there isn't more legal activity about this. Perhaps there is, because there are practices here that are clearly discriminatory. And long-term failures to succeed with a large portion of the population. I mean, surely this is something that could be pursued as, among the other approaches, one would be a legal one, which said, again, the Ann Arbor case was a landmark, but you know, the judge's recommendation for the response was to send the teachers to a workshop about, you know, language differences. And that was all that they could think of at that point. And it wasn't adequate because it didn't really address how the kids were going to be taught and how things were going to improve. Surely there's room for a legal approach to this. I hope that there are people out there who are pursuing this, because it seems, are there obstacles to doing this that I don't know about?
Yeah, you know, the reality is that some people do take the legal approach, but remember the Black English decision. So you take the legal approach, there's an acknowledgement that yes, there's discrimination involved and we need to change that. But then there's not the knowledge generation or professional development needed to make sure those changes happen. I mean, we're seeing, I can't remember the name of the case, but there's one like that happening in California in the central part of the state where discriminatory practices related to reading were identified, the court agrees. And so now there's money to try to rectify the differences. And now people are trying to figure out what the hell to do. Yeah. That's the issue with the legal route, is that you need it because it gives you the resources and it calls attention to it. But the thing that doesn't change is what the response is at the end of it all. Yeah. We have seen that for a long time now that, you know, that's an important piece, but it doesn't help us. It doesn't solve the problem because we still need for people to be educated in colleges of ed about the populations we're talking about, have it integrated into their practice, not treat the kids like it's something extra. But if you're in an urban environment, these are your students. And so this is not supplemental. This is education for you. And that's not the way it's approached.
So I guess, yeah, so that's the question. What are we going to change here? So, I mean, teachers are in their preparation, prospective teachers are already taught about cultural differences, and they got to get a lot of stuff about, you know, recognizing cultural variation and so on. But it doesn't come down to the, you know, culturally relevant instruction is a concept that people have absorbed. However, it doesn't get down to the level of, okay, this kid, now what are we going to do instructionally? Now what is going to be most effective for this child? Now what are we going to do at the level of facilitating this kid's learning? I'm wondering what you think about, you know, that sort of gap. There's a gap. It can't just be, listen, having materials that are reflective of the child's culture and background, great. Having the child feel that their educational environment is theirs and that they are not just guests in somebody else's culture. Yeah. There's a bunch of very general sort of ideas related to, you know, accommodating differences in culture. I think we need to push it to the next level of detail, which is, okay, well, what are you going to teach that takes this into account? And that's where I think so what's culturally relevant instruction in reading going to be like?
Exactly. So there's a lot of, even in my own work, there's a lot of conversation about what needs to be, what the issues are, but not enough detail about what we need to do. And that's what teachers really need. And it's what principals need. So when you are faced with a school full of kids who have speak a linguistic variety or have a culture that really influences how they learn, which is everybody, what do you do? Is there something you need to do differently? And if that's true, what is it? You know, I've been doing some work with LA Unified School District and they're working on that. When you think about, we see all these things all the time about, oh, you know, in the Chicago public schools, there are 200 different languages, you know, or things like that, that we're always quantifying that. But attached to each of those languages is a variety and a culture that's different. So what does that mean for the way that you teach? We never get to that, like that next level. And so I agree with you, that's where we are. And so in that American Educator article, we did try to make some suggestions for what teachers should do. And interestingly, I have to say, you know, in this forum, that I have always been fairly resistant to that because I'm a speech pathologist, not a teacher. And I always feel like you need more and more evidence. And you're the one who kept saying, we know enough, we know enough, we know enough. Let's make some recommendations. And you're right. We do need to get to that place. And so I do think that that's where we need to be, not only as researchers, but I don't see this happening in schools of education. And we're starting to see schools of education come under attack for this, that there's discussion about culturally relevant pedagogy, but what does that mean in the day-to-day life of a teacher? So what does a teacher do differently on Monday when they are engaged in a culturally relevant environment? What does that mean? We have the theory, thanks to Gloria Ladson Billings and people since her original theory who have expanded it and built on it, but what practices do we need to put in place? That is the piece that's missing.
Yeah, and so I think
practice, evidence-based practice.
Yeah, I mean, so I think you take what we've learned about how kids learn to read, which is the same for, you know, in the absence of conditions like, you know, developmental learning or language or reading conditions that affect people's learning. In the broad range of cases, what people have to learn is the same. But then you have to set up the experiences that are relevant to them that are going to allow them to get there. And at this point, you know, often we can say more about what not to do than what to do. I mean, it's pretty clear what not to do. What not to do is you have to look and see if your materials land the same way with kids as they are intended to. If you're teaching phonics or phonemic awareness or vocabulary, if you're asking kids to read out loud and trying to track their progress and so on, you have to think about how those things function for those kids, given their language and other aspects of their background. And is there a curriculum to point to that handles these things so that it's, you know, easier to implement? Not that I know of. But one can start. The recognition is the first step. And with wider recognition, people will produce the materials that are better and that are it's still based on the same theory of how kids learn and how reading works. It's just using materials that actually now are effective given where the kids, given the kids' background. And that stuff is still coming. So right now, you know, we're flagging things like the way that assessments work or don't work is another just a it's such an enormous issue that there's so much imprecision and inaccuracy in assessment because the standard instruments people use, the standard tools people use just are not sensitive to language variation. They're presuming things about language, the standard language that just aren't true of large numbers of people. And the potential negative effects of misassessment are enormous. So look at assessment, see if it's valid. Look at instructional, what you're doing in that day's class to illustrate something about how reading works or how phonics works or every aspect of language in the classroom. It really it has to be looked at because of these sorts the variation that exists. And we can at least be more aware of it.
And yeah, and once we are aware of it too, I'll say a couple of things about what you just said about both assessment and about what happens when the curricula that we develop don't actually meet the needs of particular populations of children. The first thing is don't blame it on the kids, which is what we do now. Yeah. So the kids don't work well in the curriculum. No, the curriculum doesn't work well with the kids. So just switching that thinking is a completely, would result in different approaches to it. It's about how the curriculum works with the kids, not just how the kids work with the curriculum. And so the idea that, well, they just don't do well with this, when you have a, that's one of the things that makes my thinking different as a speech pathologist. That when I see a child who's having difficulty, I never blame it on the child. I always assume that there's something underlying that performance that I need to get a handle on. That's a very different way of thinking than to think, you know, the kids, none of these Black kids can do this, so therefore there's a Black kid problem. No, there's a curriculum problem. And so we need to do something different with the curriculum. The other thing is related to assessment. One of our responses to the imprecision with assessment has been to give kids credit for things they don't actually know. So when we see, especially in speech pathology, when we see items that might be impacted by dialect, like, you know, deletion of the copula. So this is a red car becomes this a red car. if the child says this is a red car, we automatically give them credit for it, you know, because it was a dialect production, unless it wasn't, unless it's a child that just doesn't understand the copula, right? Yeah. And so our approach has not been to create assessments that reflect what kids know about language. Instead, we allow whatever we see on the surface to dictate the way that we're scoring. And that's a problem too, because it does result in kids who actually might need support not getting it, because you assume that everything that you see that's different is dialect or culturally based. Not true, not true, not true. As a teacher, it means that you need to learn, and a speech pathologist, you need to learn the culture of the kids you serve so that when you see something that deviates from it, you know it. You need to learn the language system that your children are using so that when you see something that's different from that, you recognize it. All the rest of the kids are doing this, but Mark is doing this, so this is not dialect. So we have a tendency to do this all or nothing thing. That doesn't help kids either. And so the first step for teachers is to become knowledgeable about the cultural practices and the linguistic system that your kids are using, so that when you encounter points in the curriculum where you need to teach more deeply or give more examples, you know that you need to do that. And so, you know, I think if we were treating our kids like individuals instead of one big monolithic group of brown, impoverished people, we could make a dent in this.
I agree. I also think if we, there are certain things that aren't just about individual children. They're about groups of children from similar backgrounds. And so we can actually develop materials that will work much better for many more kids. Then we will be in a position to take into account individual differences, things about that particular kid. So, we're a long way from that. So, there's a publishing industry that really has to get on board, and teacher education. There's linguistics 101. You know, it's interesting to me that when people do professional development related to reading, things like letters, for example, there's a lot about phonology, and people will, you know, make lots of phonological distinctions and introduce lots of terms, and yet they're not getting at one of the major components of phonology that's relevant to reading, namely that it's variable, that it's not across kids, that the number of phonemes actually in a word is going to vary, or that the number of syllables in a word is going to vary. And I just find it really ironic and unfortunate that we have so much emphasis on phonology, which is really important, and yet we're missing this huge element of it, which is the variability. And that's really important to understand and take into account.
I agree. And, you know, when we talk about language variation and dialect, I focus on African-American kids. And teachers know in different parts of the country, there's also regional variation. So since I moved to California, I have learned a lot about linguistic varieties that I had no experience with. And in those, like Chicano English, Hawaiian English, the phonological system is significantly impacted. And so in almost every variety, we're going to find these phonological differences that impact teaching phonological and phonemic awareness. So I agree completely that
I think that's not
paying enough attention.
No, I'm going to have more to say about this, because I think the instructional practices related to phonology, phonemic awareness, phonological awareness, and so on has gone pretty off track. And so it's not working in a lot of ways. but it's particularly not working with respect to this kind of variation. And as you say, of course, it's not just about African-American kids in AAE. This kind of variation is seen in languages, and it's seen in regions, and it's seen in groups that are identifiable by cultural background or ethnicity and other things like that. So indeed, the same issues are going to arise in a lot of other contexts, and we know that.
Yeah, and so again, I keep saying this, as a teacher, you can say when you hear an African-American or a Mexican or a Hawaiian child doing these things that are different phonologically, this kid can't produce S. Or you can say, wow, the way that this child produces the S is different than in general American English, so I need to spend more time on it. So you can see it as an error, or you can see it as a difference. And what it is a difference. It is not an error. And the way you approach it, the way you approach it will be different.
I think the other thing is, absolutely. The other thing, though, is it's going to take more time. There's more to learn, and you have to give the kid enough opportunities to learn. They don't have enough opportunities to learn the stuff. If they don't have enough time, then they're not going to be able to pick it up. If they do have effective instruction and enough opportunities, of course, they can learn this. They're learning alternative ways of doing things. It's fine.
That's right.
So let me just ask you something. So here's a proposal. People talk about achievement gaps. They talk about the data, which are low reading achievement in the US in general for, but particularly in children who are at risk because of poverty or low income, and also among say African-American kids, among other groups. So people talk about all of these low reading achievement. I would say, so here's a proposal hypothesis for you. Again, leaving aside, you know, conditions, developmental conditions that really do exist and interfere with learning. Kids are showing up, African-American kids, among others, are showing up on the first day of kindergarten behind in a lot of areas that are relevant to early reading success. It could be vocabulary, it could be knowledge of letters and sounds, it could be a variety of things. That's not because of the way they were taught to read. Those are things that are existing before they even get to school. And so what I would propose to you is, all these reading difficulties that people are talking about are actually really not about reading. They're really about the language and the aspects of spoken language that reading depends on. So when you find a child who's falling behind in reading, my question is, does this have anything to do with reading at all? Or is it just that this child is perfectly able to learn about spelling, orthography? They're perfectly able to learn about the pronunciations of words and learn new vocabulary. They're not, they're fine in, with respect to their ability, capacity to learn. However, spoken language and experiences and background and knowledge of the things we use language to talk about, those things differ. And so what I'm suggesting for you to tear down is these problems are not by and large about reading. They are secondary to issues about spoken language and your experience of the world. And that if we could really focus a lot of energy and resources on that, early language experience, early widening experience, kids' experience of the world beyond as much as possible, then they'd be better prepared to learn and to take advantage of instruction once they get to school. So, you know, my first question about all these kids is, do any of them have reading problems, or are these things really about the precursors of reading, the things that reading depends on, which is where we should be focusing our efforts?
That's a really interesting question, and I didn't think that's where you were going. But I do think they have reading problems, but I agree with you that reading is the outcome. The issue is the language problem, the spoken language issues that lead to it. And even when you are talking about the achievement gap, I wrote down, we're focused on the outcome, which is the achievement gap, but what actually creates it is the opportunity gap. And so it's about opportunities. And then we see the achievement gap as the outcome. Same is true with reading. It's about spoken language variation, spoken language, sometimes deficits, and then the outcome is a reading problem. So is it really a reading problem? Well, the outcome is reading, but you're right. What in order to address the reading problem, we need to take a step back and think about language, which is what we have not done.
So as soon as the child gets to school, and there's reading instruction, they're supposed to be learning how to read. If the child is struggling, it's at that point, it's treated as a reading problem that needs a reading solution, like more instruction about this or that, about print and so on. Well, no, it might be that that kid's ability to learn about print is fine, but learning about print depends on your knowledge of spoken language. Right. And, you know, so I know it's not all about spoken language and experience using it in a variety of settings and in a variety of ways. It's not only about that, but if a child is struggling with reading, the first question to ask is really, what's their spoken language like? Are there things that we could be building there? And that will then make reading that much easier and allow them to be more successful. And the important point being, spoken language continues to develop after the kid gets to school. It needs to. And so, you know, if we shift our emphasis entirely to reading instruction, we might be overlooking this fact that children's spoken language is really continuing to develop. There are lots of kids who need to learn things that are important for the classroom. And in some instructional practices and activities also have to continue in the school years addressing spoken language to be able to allow those kids to benefit from reading instruction. What do you think?
I agree. And some of it is knowledge of spoken language. Some of it is the structure of spoken language. So
what do you mean?
So for example, you could think about it as knowledge, but for example, when we talk about phonemic awareness and we're talking about, you know, identification of T in the final position of words. Well, if you're a child for whom the final consonant is variable, then the structure of the language that you use is going to influence how long it takes you to identify the phoneme in the final position. So the trajectory is impacted. It has nothing to do with your phonemic awareness, because the reality is, if you ask me the same question in the initial position of words or the medial position, I would get it. But in the final position, the structure of my language is different. And so it's going to take me a little longer to identify that final position. And so it's not about your knowledge of language. It's about the fact that the phoneme is variable in your language. And so the structure of your own language system influences when, not if, but when you are going to be able to complete that particular task. And those are things we never take into account.
No, that's like, you know, the earlier point about the instruction doesn't land the same way for the kid for whom that final phoneme is a variable, and assessment and other things. But, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm perseverating on one issue, but I'm not convinced that kids actually have particular difficulties identifying letters.
Me either.
Orthography, spelling, except insofar as they are dependent on things like, well, if you have a larger vocabulary, then you're more likely to be able to pull the words apart into components and so on. Basically, how many of these real areas where kids are struggling could be traced back to spoken language? And if that's true, what can we do about it? I think we can do a lot. Kids are great at learning spoken language. You need to provide a range of experiences for them before they get to school.
Exactly. And so, but in the case of the child growing up in poverty, it becomes not just about spoken language, but the addition of spoken language and world knowledge.
Yeah.
And so it's world knowledge for those kids that often results in sort of difficulty with development of things like vocabulary. And because of the way we approach them, again, back to our instructional practices, kids don't actually get to show you what they know. You know, when I was first starting this work, I was working in a school district in Michigan, and it was right on the edge of Detroit. And we had these kids in preschool. They were in a Head Start classroom who taught me that a lot of kids growing up in poverty have the conceptual knowledge, but not the concrete vocabulary item to go with it. So it's not about what they know. It's about being able to attach that specific vocabulary item to it. So for example, let me give you an example. So it's my favorite example of a little girl who I was in a Head Start classroom. Head Start was serving vegetables because they decided that, you know, we need to be focused on nutrition. So there were two kids eating a different vegetable. And I said to the little boy, what are you eating? He said a carrot. And I asked the little girl, what are you eating? And she said a no-hot. And so it was fascinating because it was like, okay, if conceptually you know what you're eating, but you don't know the word for it, what's a no-hot? Well, it's a pepper that's not hot. So it's a bell pepper. So she could describe it to me. And I saw that over and over again, where kids had the knowledge, but not the word to attach to the concept. So we're underestimating them.
These children are not stupid.
No, they know a lot.
I'm sorry, I maybe there's a more subtle way, gracious way to put it, but there's nothing, the child is not cognitively impaired. Oh. What you learn about words and, you know, I think vocabulary is obviously totally tied to your experience of the world. If you have broader experience of the world, you're going to have more opportunities to learn a broader range of words. So, you know, knowledge of the world, knowledge of the language, these things are totally tied together. But the children are not mentally challenged. It's not that they aren't learners. It's not that they have some impairment. Their experiences, they need to have the experiences that support learning the things that are valuable for becoming a reader and doing all these, being able to do all these other things that are going to happen in school. Yes. You know, I think people jump to like concluding there's something wrong with the kid.
Always. And they're not blank slates. They know a lot when they come to school. It just doesn't always match what you're teaching at school, but it doesn't mean they don't know it. And, you know, the idea that the kids aren't, you know, they're not motivated. They are not knowledgeable. They're knowledgeable about a lot of things, but it isn't always exactly what you're teaching. And part of our job is to get at the knowledge that they have and use it to build the knowledge that we want them to have.
Absolutely. And
we seldom do that. We just assume they don't have it and start from scratch.
Totally. I mean, there's a lot of room here for to do better because there's a plan here for what to do, right? There's a way of taking advantage of what children know. There's a way of matching materials to where the kids' background, where the kids at, so that they're more effective. There's all sorts of, there's ways of expanding kids' knowledge of exposure to the school language and other things beyond their immediate experience before they even get to school. There's all sorts of things that could be done. And at least, you know, that's the positive message. There is a path here. There has to be maybe awareness will lead to implementation of other sorts of action because there are clear paths here. We've spelled out some of them. Other people will pick up pick up on what we've suggested and take it further, I'm sure. Let me just talk about, ask you about the classroom for a second.
Okay.
So we discussed this briefly in the paper. You know, it's the question of how the teacher responds to the child's use of dialect, a variant from the school variety of English. And, you know, a lot of teachers really do not want to correct the kids or respond to them because they don't think it's their job to change the kids' language. And that's what they view it as. Either I change the kids' language into the way I talk, right, or the way the teacher talks, or I respect the language of the child and I don't provide any response to indicate that it's different from, for example, what they're going to what's relevant to the books they're reading or something. So, we can talk about ways to try to deal that with that constructively, but I think it is a real, there's either hypercorrection where if the kid uses an expression from AAE that's different, that it's treated as wrong, that's one problem. And then there's the opposite problem. I don't think we should underestimate how much impact this issue is having. How to respond, because these are all learning experiences, these are all communicating messages to kids about their language, their expectations about the classroom and the way they should behave. So is that consistent with, I mean, I'm sure that you've observed similar sorts of issues. You've been in a lot of schools in various places. This is a big issue, don't you think?
It is an issue. I mean, there was a program that was developed to teach standard English mastery. And I looked at their executive summary about how it went after, you know, 2 or 3 years. And my observation was that it was a great program and it was really evidence-based. The problem was the teachers weren't doing it. And they said they weren't doing it. That's how I knew it. They weren't comfortable with the idea of addressing somebody's language system. Why can't we just accept what kids do? You know, the reality is that as a teacher, you're really not necessarily trying to change the language system. You're trying to teach reading and writing. And if what you need to be able to do in order to teach reading is to help the child map onto reading from oral language, then that's what you have to do. And so if the child is doing something, for example, with phonology that is results in them always sort of not being able to decode a specific word, it doesn't matter whether the phonological feature comes from a cultural dialect or not. You need to address that in order to help them map onto that word and learn to decode. And so I think because this whole area of linguistic variation is also like loaded sociopolitically, that people forget what it is you're trying to do as a teacher. You're trying to teach reading and writing.
Yeah,
that's your goal. It's not about the politics of language. It's none of that stuff. It's about language and literacy. And so whatever you need to do in the oral language realm to help the child get to the written system, that's what you need to do.
Yeah, Julie, you're really just so good at really getting to the heart of it and focusing the issue in a better way. I really admire that. Yes, right. I mean, it's not about the politics of the situation, although, you know, we know there are politics. But for the teacher, it's like, we're trying to get this child to be able to read and be able to use reading for other things. And what's that going to take? Exactly. And it's not about passing judgment about anything. It's pretty practical issue, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And it's a language and education issue. It's not a political issue. It's not a race issue. It's a language and education issue. And often when we talk about this, Mark, we talk about how it's an issue around the globe. It's not about race. It's about language and education. We see the same need to be able to map onto the written system from the oral system in Arabic. We see it in Greek. We see it in Hebrew. We see it in Indian languages. We see it everywhere. Everywhere that there's a major language with a variety attached to it, which is everywhere in the world, kids need to be able to map their spoken language to the written system. This is not it's not an American issue. It's not a Black issue. It's not a white issue. It's a language and education issue, linguistic variety in reading. That's what it's about.
Indeed. And then what I want to know is who's doing a good job with it. It's a universal thing. As you say, the situation in which the child's home language differs from what they're going to need in school is common.
Yes.
So it's been around a long time. So we're not doing a good job of it in the U.S. yet. We could do better. But I want to know where it is being dealt with better, because I do know of other cases in which the situation in the U.S. is kind of repeated, where there's a poorer population, an ethnic or racial minority, many of the, they don't have the same history we have, but you know, the situation in which there's a minority language or non-standard language in the home, and that the child is at a disadvantage because the educational system is not taking that into account, I think is actually pretty common. I just certainly know of other examples in other countries. So I want to know who's doing a good job with this, because
I think a lot of people think they're doing a good job, but they're not always. But one of the areas that seems to have figured some of it out is the Caribbean, where kids are using, for example, in Jamaica, where kids are using the Jamaican patois in their communities. And when they walk into the school building, it's a different language environment. And that's the way they're taught. And so the school makes the distinction between the home language and the school language for them, so that it's very clear that this is what happens here and this is what happens there. So they're about the demarcation. And I think that's really important. I've seen that in a few systems where British English is the school system. And then you have a different system. South Africa actually is pretty good at it, even in the rural environments. And it is a place where all these different languages and the varieties within that language are valued. And then this is what we do at school. And so there's this value in language variety and language diversity, that where people value it. And so then school becomes another kind of diversity. Those are the places where it does well.
Yeah. You know, you remind me that there are Black academics who from Caribbean areas who don't see why this kind of language variation should be as much of an issue as it is in the US, because it wasn't for them.
Exactly. They're handling it better. They have a system for managing it. That doesn't mean it's equitable or everybody likes it, but it actually works. And so we see that in Jamaica. I see it in Trinidad. And so many of the Caribbean islands actually are doing a fairly good job with this. I had the opportunity to interact with people from Bermuda recently. They're struggling with it, but some of the other islands aren't. And so it's really interesting that some of the places where we don't pay quite as much attention to what they're doing, they actually are handling these issues fairly well.
You know, building on other people's successes is a reasonable thing. And that's something that needs more people know about it. It'll be really helpful. Julie, what else can we leave people with as a sort of message here? You know, I feel like this is a good example of how research is leading to better insights about things, changing views, you know, of these issues, A deeper understanding, a better evidence of causality that one thing really does affect something else, opening up various ideas for ways to change and where improvement could really occur. So to me, it's not a success story because we haven't implemented this stuff on a wide scale. But it is a potential success story because there is so much to build on. We know a lot about these topics now. And so hopefully people will get excited about them because there's so much that can be done and it would be so valuable and make such a difference.
That's right. Well, one of the things, Mark, I do want to end with myself that I wish we had said in the article.
Yeah.
So I'll say it here.
Yeah.
It is, in addition to teaching reading, don't forget to read. That's one of the things that we see, especially in urban schools, that kids are getting like this hour and a half reading block where they get all this reading instruction and then they get no opportunities to practice.
Yeah.
Good speakers talk. Good writers write. Good readers read. And so give kids the opportunity to read and practice the skills that you're teaching them. And the idea that you don't have time for it in a school day is not acceptable because you have to make time for it or you're going to see the problems later on in the upper grades. Kids need practice reading, and especially kids that we're talking about who are coming to school, like African-American kids with impoverished backgrounds, with a language system that's different than school, they need the opportunity to read. And often the only place that they're getting it is school. And so please create opportunities for kids to hear you read and to read themselves.
Yeah, so this is crucial. And of course, so the example that we both know, I remember going to a class, first grade classroom in a school where they had taken the National Reading Panel very seriously. And the reading block was divided into, you know, time devoted to each of the five pillars. And of course, I think this is a total mistake because it misses the fact that all of those things are actually related and build on each other. And moreover, there wasn't any time for reading left. So this is something we need to correction of course here. The thing about reading time, the other thing though is they need reading time with feedback. They need reading time practice with some kind of feedback about how they're doing and you know, understanding. You can't just send the kid off. At some point you can send the kid off with a book, but until they reach a certain level of,
right,
you know, under basic skills, they need feedback. And having enough time to provide enough feedback is a really big thing. Trying to find ways to increase it is a really big thing. And so I agree, kids need the opportunities to read. They need the practice. They also along the way need feedback about how they're doing.
That's right.
And so they can learn from it. And, but these things are doable.
That's right. I know they are. They really are. It's just that I think that sometimes, especially if you're a teacher in a school where kids experiencing poverty or homelessness are the majority of your population, you're so busy and so stressed that you can't even think about some of these kinds of things and making time for them. And I promise you, they will pay off for you. So make the time.
I want those classrooms to have more resources in terms of teaching, supplemental teaching, people who can have two teachers in every classroom. I mean, really, more resources in the classroom. The excuse that, you know, the fact that the teacher has enormous responsibilities and doesn't have time to do all these things him or herself, that's true. Now let's get more resources in there, support of various other sorts, other personnel who can really be taking some of the load so that the job can get done.
Okay.
I don't want to blame the teachers. I think that having more support in the classroom would be just really great.
I agree. And teachers are doing a good job with what we're giving them, and they can do better when we do better.
Yeah. Julie, it's been great talking to you as always.
Always, always. Talking to a friend is always good.
Yeah. Anyway, if people want to know more about Julie and her background and other things that and see a really beautiful picture of her, there was an article that focused on her in The Atlantic a couple of years ago now. Maybe we could post that on our website as well. It was a really nice piece. And Julie, I'm really grateful to you. And I hope this is helpful to people in the audience. I think it's going to be. I really do.
Thank you, Mark.
Pleasure. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this reading meeting recording. You can find more information about past and future reading meetings on our website. We hope you'll join us for future meetings.